silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Are you ready to proceed? Okay, then I will call our third case of the day, State versus Wiskerson.
Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Jeremy Newman. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the petitioner, Sean Wiskerson. Wisconsin's criminal restitution statute...
Make sure you speak up, counsel. I have some difficulty in hearing.
Sure. Thank you. Wisconsin's criminal restitution statute serves noble purposes that are achieved when courts apply the plain text of the statute as written by the legislature. What the statute authorizes is restitution for a victim's losses caused by a crime considered at sentencing. As Judge Hagedorn's dissenting opinion aptly argues, the majority opinion in this case and the Court of Appeals decision in State v. Cueva are fundamentally flawed because the analysis upon which they each rely is detached from the statutory text and allows for criminal restitution not caused by a crime considered at sentencing.
Counsel, I'm going to ask you a question right off the bat on subsection 1R of the statute. It says that the court shall order the defendant to make full or partial restitution under this section to any victim of a crime considered at sentencing. Could that language be construed to create a class or category of people who the court must order restitution for, rather than restricting the scope of the restitution award?
So I think it does create one requirement under the statute that in order for the court to order restitution, the victim that is being, or that is at least potentially claiming restitution, they must be a victim of a crime considered at sentencing, not some other crime. But that's just one requirement in the statute. And then the court, courts must proceed, as the statute reads, under this section. Restitution is generally required, and there is a presumption for restitution as long as it's otherwise permitted by the statute. So, yes, I think it does create, to some extent, one requirement that if the victim is not a crime, if the person claiming restitution is not a victim of a crime considered at sentencing, then regardless of any other potential claims, that restitution would be unauthorized.
And that part of the statute doesn't say that restitution is restricted to crimes. Let me restart. That's going to be a really bad question, so let me restart. The statute does not say that the restitution is restricted to or must be for a crime considered at sentencing or as a result of a crime considered at sentencing. And the reason I'm asking you that is because in subsection 13A, the court shall consider all of the following: the amount of loss suffered by any victim as a result of a crime considered at sentencing. But that as a result of language is not used in sub 1R.
Yeah, and I agree that it's not the as a result of or caused by a crime considered at sentencing is not used in sub 1R. It is used throughout the rest of the statute repeatedly. I don't have a great explanation for why it's not used there, other than to some extent it makes clear that one requirement and maybe the prerequisite for criminal restitution is that the victim must be a victim of a crime considered at sentencing.
Is there anywhere in the statute that restricts the trial court judge to ordering restitution that's only as a result of the crime or a crime considered at sentencing?
Yes, I think so, Your Honor. So I would, other than subsection 1G, which defines the term, is I would start with subsection 2 and proceed to subsection 3, 4, and 5. So subsection 2 reads, if a crime considered at sentencing resulted in damage to or loss or destruction of property. Subsection 3 says if a crime considered at sentencing resulted in bodily injury. Sub 4 likewise deals with if a crime considered at sentencing resulted in death. And as I would finish with, to some extent, subsection 5, which starts with in any case and then proceeds to limit restitution to all special damages but not general damages. This is in paragraph A, substantiated by evidence in the record, which could be recovered in a civil action against the defendant for his or her conduct in the commission of a crime considered at sentencing. So that's subsection 5.
But none of those sections tie the hands of the circuit court judge, do they? For example, let's start with the first section you mentioned. Subsection 2 speaks to the court may require that the defendant do a number of things in order to try to make the victim whole, but it doesn't, again, restrict the trial court from going beyond crimes considered at sentencing in determining how much restitution should be ordered.
Respectfully, I would disagree. I think that language, that if a crime considered at sentencing resulted in, or as stated in different subsections, caused the damage, then the court has discretion to proceed under one of those paragraphs or subdivisions. So the court has discretion, if otherwise lawfully permitted, to determine whether to and how to and specifically how to and for what specific bases to order restitution. And that can be full or partial restitution, obviously. But I would respectfully disagree that I think other than sub 1R, which doesn't specifically have a causation requirement, subsections 2 through 5, and then proceeding with 13 that we just talked about and 14, they all have a more explicit and an explicit causation requirement. And then they proceed to allow courts, I would agree, generally wide discretion to determine how and whether to order full or partial restitution.
Well, the state is pointing to 13A5, which gives the court the ability to consider any other factors which the court deems appropriate. In fact, the statute mandates that the trial court consider any other factors which the court deems appropriate in determining whether to order restitution and the amount thereof. Subsection 1 of 13A speaks specifically to any victim as a result of a crime considered at sentencing, but the catch-all provision on which the state relies does not.
Sure. So I think that's exactly what the state argues, that this discretionary catch-all provision, so this subsection is lays out the court's wide discretion to consider these factors and any other factors related to those in determining whether to order restitution and the amount thereof. So I think that's part of the court's exercise of discretion, but the court doesn't get to the exercise of discretion unless it is lawfully and otherwise able to order restitution under the statute.
Thank you.
This is my problem, one of my many problems. This is the problem that I have in your position. I don't want your interpretation to lead to absurd results. In this case, the victim made a claim for property that likely was not taken on May 8th, which I think is the date of the charge for which the defendant was convicted. The victim has a burden, I think by a preponderance of evidence, to show entitlement to restitution. Under the facts of this case, how can the victim show, or let me ask, is the victim able to show that any specific ring for which she claims
restitution was taken on May 8th.
Yeah, to some extent, I would agree that in this case, I think the record is clear that the victim attempted to, but was unable to show whether any property was taken, whether any of the listed property that she sought restitution for was taken on that date or as a result of that burglary or any crime considered at sentencing. That's obviously not the case in every case. And the facts here certainly could have been different. With Mr. Wiskirchen, imagine if he was caught with a backpack full of items.
Sure. That's not the facts that we have here.
Sure.
And to order no restitution, I'm concerned, might result in an absurd result.
So I think what I would say is this court, following the plain text of the statute and the well-established precedent that specifically limits restitution to losses that are proven by the victim by a preponderance of the evidence. That's in the statute. That's not obviously created by the defense or anybody else. That's what the legislature enacted.
But there also is the restitution statute, quote, reflects a strong, equitable public policy that victims should not have to bear the burden of losses if the defendant is capable of making restitution. To that end, the restitution statute should be interpreted broadly and liberally in order to allow victims to recover their losses as a result of the defendant's criminal conduct. That is a much more, I'll use the term, more liberal construction, consistent with the public policy behind the statute as set forth by the Court of Appeals decision, citing precedent. And it just seems to me that you're setting up the victim in this case for an impossible task. The only one that knows the answer to what was taken on May 8th, if anything, is the defendant in this case.
Yes, the other thing I would point out, and I think this does answer your question and the concern, which was probably the concern of the circuit court, was that the victim does have other options here. The statute specifically reserves and preserves this victim's right the day after sentencing, the day after this offense, today, tomorrow, to file a civil action for damages and seek any and all compensation damages, including which are not provided in the statute, general damages, pain and suffering, anything else. She can pursue on her own those actions. But when it's based on a crime in the criminal code, the statute has limited it, and that's obviously our position, has limited the basis and the scope of restitution to either losses that were caused by something that the defendant is convicted of, or I think in the other option, besides pursuing a civil action on her own. The statute allows for restitution for crimes that were not the basis for a conviction or were not caused by specifically, let's say, that May 8th burglary to which Mr. Wiskirchen pled. But district attorneys do this every day. They pursue charges specifically to obtain restitution for victims. So part of the process and part of the process that's laid out in the statute is that the state and the victim isn't left with having to get a conviction. What they can get is that they can get and agree to, pursuant to a plea agreement, have certain charges read in that the defendant is not convicted of, he's not admitting guilt to, he's not being punished or sentenced for. But the statute provides for a way for, for example, in this case, the district attorney or the assistant district attorney could have pursued charges related to prior burglaries if the state believed it had probable cause.
Was there a PSI here?
Mm-hmm. There was.
Okay. And did the PSI narrate any of Mr. Wiskerson's conduct aside from that for which he was convicted?
My understanding of the record is that the victim's allegations of any prior alleged burglaries the PSI is where they first came to light, where they first appear in the record. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence up until that point, so until after the plea and, you know, in between the plea and sentencing. That, I think, is when these other allegations came to light. The victim obviously made statements and made claims about what she thought happened. Mr. Wiskirchen, in his portion of the PSI, did contest those allegations, did think that the victim was wrong about what he did and what he stole. But that's the first time these other allegations came to light.
But the PSI was available to the judge before the sentencing occurred, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And would you agree with me that a judge at sentencing can take into account not just read-ins and the conduct of which there is either conviction or a plea, but other conduct of the defendant?
Yes, absolutely. I agree 100%. I think that's a clear and important distinction to make here, that in terms of criminal sentencing, these alleged crimes that the victim alleged that Mr. Wiskirchen committed, they are completely fair game for the sentencing court to consider when imposing sentence upon Mr. Wiskirchen. And
why aren't they fair game then for restitution?
Because of the criminal restitution statute and all of the well-established precedent that makes that distinction clear, that sentencing is one thing, restitution is another. And in terms of considering crimes in terms of the scope of criminal restitution, the statute limits that to any crime considered at sentencing or any losses caused by a crime considered at sentencing or any writing crime. So writing crimes and crimes considered at sentencing are...
Sub 1R doesn't say any crime convicted for which a conviction was had at sentencing or read, and it just says any crime considered at sentencing. So when the judge reads the PSI, why isn't that part of what he considers at sentencing? Does he have to narrate that he's relying on parts of the PSI? Or?
Well, I what I would say is subsection 1R has to be read in context and in light of all the other subsections of the statute, which I think do create this causal nexus requirement, which is what all the
people
talk
about. Well, if you get to 5D,
about.
There's no causal nexus there.
Well, 1GA defines a crime considered at sentencing. Isn't that what you're relying on?
Yes, he is. Yes.
Any crime for which the defendant was convicted in any read-in.
Yes, exactly.
But you want to limit it, and I guess what I'm trying to go over with you is that there are subsections of 973.20.1G, I guess is where we are for all of this stuff, that aren't tied to either a crime read in at sentencing or the crime of conviction. Neither 1R nor 5D. 5D is just kind of an open purse for the court to look and see what the court believes is important for sentencing in regard to restitution.
I'm sorry, you were talking about sub D?
D.
D. I think
if justice so requires, reimburse any insurer or other who has compensated a victim for a loss otherwise compensable under this section. So you think that will apply only if we got an insurance company involved?
To some extent, but I think that the final words of that subsection or paragraph are relevant and are similar to what's found in subsection 1R, that you look at whether losses are otherwise compensable under that section, and similarly under sub 1R, there's similar language under this section. So there are specific subsections or paragraphs and subdivisions within the statute where the legislature doesn't repeat itself over and over and over.
Let's see if I understand your argument. And that is, it includes, generally, a court can consider anything at sentencing, certainly uncharged conduct. And that's been our jurisprudence for a while. It doesn't have to be the charged crime. It doesn't have to be a read-in. It can be an uncharged crime that a court can consider at sentencing. But, as I understand your argument, the restitution statute throws a little wrinkle into that general premise. And that wrinkle is that it defines what it means for purposes of restitution for consideration at sentencing. And it narrows it. And it says we mean consideration at sentencing in the context of restitution to apply only to the crime for which the defendant was convicted or for which there was an actual reading. Is that your argument?
Yes, that's absolutely my argument. If that wasn't clear, I thank you for that. But I think that's especially
trying to help.
I think it is especially relevant to look at this statute within the context. I mean, obviously this is part of the sentencing statute. It's restitution is generally part of sentencing. It either occurs during sentencing, immediately after, or sometime after sentencing. And when it's generally known and it's consistent for decades, as far as I'm aware, probably longer, that courts have almost unlimited discretion to consider convictions, consider read-in charges, consider allegations, consider acquittals, all of that. That when you have a statute specifically about restitution, that does have all of this language specifically defining what within this context a crime considered at sentencing means, as opposed to the general context that we use, I guess, every day in at sentencing hearings.
Counsel, the defendant was convicted of burglary, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And these incidents happened within a relatively short period of time, each of these losses, correct?
Are you referring to the allegations that the victim makes?
Yes.
About prior burglaries?
Yes.
I don't think the record's clear, because essentially what we have are the victim's allegations about when she thinks these alleged burglaries happened, if they did at all.
So let's say the court was inclined to accept her understanding when these things occurred. Is there any reason the court could not consider that one continuing course of conduct?
Yes. So my first response would be to go back to the statutory text. So I would go back to paragraph 5A, which sort of differently than subsections 2, 3, and 4, which talk generally about if a crime considered at sentencing resulted in.
Mm-hmm.
Paragraph 5A specifically says, I think it does define and limit the scope of a crime considered at sentencing to the defendant's conduct in the commission of a crime considered at sentencing. So that really does limit it to the conduct during that crime. It's not conduct that's similar to or involves the same victim or involves the same modus operandi.
But that only applies to the payment of special damages, correct?
Yep. No, respectfully.
And general damages.
I'm sorry,
go ahead.
Okay. I would disagree. I think subsection 5 is, of any of those subsections 2 through 5, subsection 5 applies in any case, that the restitution order may require that the defendant do one of the following. And then it limits...
But it's making reference to payment of all special damages, and then it goes on to say, but not general damages. So it's a particular category of damages, not the whole scope of damages that the victim may have sustained. Right?
I don't think it's limited to special damages versus general damages. I think that is one limitation on the scope of criminal restitution, that that essentially if restitution is authorized, if the victim could go out and file a civil action and receive compensation for these damages, they have to be general and not special under the restitution statute. But I think that is the only portion of the statute which does give a definition to and some scope to the term crime considered at sentencing. So I guess the next place I would go, other than the statute, is all the case law that comes before State v. Cleaver.
Do you agree or disagree that the other times he would have entered her home would have been crimes? He had no right to be there.
Yes, if somebody, if he did enter her home.
And I'm looking at the transcript again. It looks like that fact was considered at sentencing, right? The fact that
yes,
he entered her home on numerous occasions and she believes he stole from her?
Yes, which is perfectly acceptable for when we're talking about sentencing.
So that would be considered an uncharged crime, even though it's not technically charged,
sure,
dismissed, and read in, right?
Sure. Those prior alleged burglaries were uncharged.
So what do you do with 973-20-1GB that specifically defines for purposes of restitution the word read-in crime to mean any crime uncharged?
Yeah, so I would continue with that paragraph. So
or that is dismissed and read in.
Yeah, so any uncharged crime or that is, sorry, I'll just start from the very start of that paragraph. A read-in crime means any crime that is uncharged or that is dismissed as part of the plea agreement, and that the defendant agrees to be considered by the court at the time of sentencing, and that the court considers at the time of sentencing. So I think
what
gets
of that
to
point, is missing?
Yes, is that these were not uncharged as part of the plea agreement.
They were uncharged crimes considered by the court at the time of sentencing.
Yes, but they were not uncharged pursuant to and based on the defendant's plea and the agreement between the parties. So
in other
case,
words, counsel, I think your argument is that the defendant never agreed that those crimes could be considered by the court.
Yeah, so I see my red light is on. Can I finish?
Yeah, yes, please.
And I guess one thing to clarify is that the case law and the statutory history is clear that the defendant doesn't have to get up during sentencing and say, I agree that you may consider this crime in deciding whether to order restitution. But it's an agreement based on the fact that something was part of a plea agreement and that certain charges were either dismissed as part of the plea agreement or were uncharged as part of the plea agreement. In terms of the record here, what I would say is that I would point to the plea questionnaire form, which does explicitly lay out, and I think the only point in the record that does make explicit what the terms of the plea agreement are, and it does note that certain, I think it's counts 1, 2, and 4, were dismissed as part of the plea agreement, and potential future charges related to intimidation or tampering with a witness was uncharged as part of the plea agreement. And that's supported by, trial counsel's filings in the case. I think the record is absolutely clear that these uncharged burglaries were not read-ins under the statute and under this court's case law.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Deputy Solicitor General Sopan Shaw for the State of Wisconsin. Wiskirchen broke into ND's home, created a secret nest in her bedroom closet, and used it as a hideout over the course of 2 weeks to steal valuable and treasured items to obtain money for drugs. ND caught him in the act on May 8, 2015, and the state proved that he committed burglary beyond a reasonable doubt. The circuit court, in its broad discretion, determined that Wiskirchen shouldn't be able to keep ND's property that he had stolen before. Any other result would violate ND's constitutional rights as a victim of crime under Wisconsin's special constitutional provision for victims in Article 1, Section 9M.
Did the circuit court make any factual findings that these items that were being claimed were taken by the defendant?
The circuit court concluded that a preponderance of the evidence showed that these losses were responsible or were attributable to Wiskirchen's criminal conduct. And I'd actually like to go over the evidence supporting that conclusion.
My question wasn't with regard to a conclusion. My question was with regard to factual findings.
The circuit court did conclude.
No, did make factual findings. Like in the, as I recall, in the Weaver case, there were specific factual findings made by the circuit court. That's my recollection. And I'm asking if in this case the record reflects specific factual findings.
So the circuit court found a causal nexus between Whiskerton's criminal conduct and the losses that ND claimed. And the circuit court additionally stated that she had met, ND had met her burden. It may not have laid out the factual findings as specifically as Your Honor is referring to in Weaver, but there was a wealth of evidence supporting this conclusion. So Whiskerton, by his own admission to the PSI writer, knew that ND had, quote unquote, some money in her home.
Right. Before we go through an exhaustive recitation of the factual findings, perhaps you could help me understand the framework within which to consider them. I'm wondering, do the losses have to flow from the crime for which he was convicted?
The losses must be attributable to his criminal conduct, and that criminal conduct needs to have some relationship to the crime for which he was convicted.
Okay, so let's use some of the statutory language. So restitution is available for a crime considered at sentencing, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And crime considered at sentencing is the crime for which convicted, plus read-ins, plus any uncharged as a part of the plea agreement were not charged, right?
You're right, Your Honor. Sorry, I missed the last part of what you were saying.
It has to be, where does it say uncharged that were part of the plea agreement that were not charged? Where does it say that in the statute?
So that comes in the statute with sections 1R and section 13. So section 1R mandates that the court order full restitution. And then
right. It doesn't say uncharged as part of a plea agreement, though.
Well, it says it says uncharged or that is dismissed as part of a plea agreement, right?
We're discussing
I'm sorry, 1G sub B. A read-in crime means any crime that is uncharged or that is dismissed as part of a plea agreement.
That's correct, that the statute does say that,
okay,
Your Honor.
So if part of the plea agreement there is an agreement not to charge, that would be an uncharged crime, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. So getting back to the to my original question, is it if restitution is available only for crimes considered at sentencing, and crime considered at sentencing is the read-in crime, as defined in 1G sub B, how would you rope in these prior instances as part of a crime considered at sentencing?
It is under Section 13, Factor 5, right? Any other factor, which mandates that the court consider any other factor it deems appropriate. Now, importantly, Factor 1 says the amount of loss suffered by any victim as a result of a crime considered at sentencing.
Right.
Thus, Factor 5 represents explicit authorization for the court to consider other conduct that it deems appropriate.
Okay, and so if Factor 5 gives you the ability to consider loss as a result of any criminal activity, why do you need Factor 1?
Factor 1 is also available to the court in order to...
Well, yes, but if Factor 5 means what you say it does, then Factor 1 is kind of surplusage, isn't it?
I think it's helpful... No, Your Honor. I think that it's meant exactly for situations like this, where someone's course of criminal conduct extends, and in order to make the victim whole, you know, it's undisputed that the court must construe the statute broadly in order to make a victim whole, to return him or her to their original position before the criminal conduct of the defendant began.
Okay, and so if Factor 1, instead of reading the way it does, if it read the amount of loss suffered by any victim, would there be any difference in the meaning?
With respect to Factor 1.
Mm-hmm. So we could we just chop off the the last part of that, as a result of a crime considered at sentencing. Could we just eliminate that and have the same meaning for that provision?
I believe that under 1R, it would effectively have the same result. But it actually bolsters, the fact that those words are there bolsters the state's argument that factor 5 represents authorization to go beyond the losses as a result of
crime. Yeah, let me just make sure I understand your position on 1. So your position on factor 1 under 13A is that the amount of loss suffered by any victim means the exact same thing as the amount of loss suffered by any victim as a result of a crime considered offense.
Yes, read in conjunction with section 1R.
Doesn't that acknowledge then that as a result of a crime considered sentencing, it's surplusage?
I think it merely sort of bolsters what brought the court to this position in the first place, right? So the reason that we're in the restitution proceeding is the result of criminal conduct. And so section 13 says, court, you must consider the loss that results from a crime for which we're in the sentencing proceeding, and you must also consider any other factor you deem appropriate. And I think the word any means, you know, the United States Supreme Court has said that that is very broad. It allows the court to consider anything. Other suggests that it's a factor over and above, in addition to the loss as a result of a crime considered at sentencing, and read in conjunction with Section 1R, which states that the court must order full restitution to any victim.
So if that's what Factor 5 means, then Factor 1 effectively means that the amount of loss suffered by any victim as a result of a crime, whether or not considered at sentencing.
I think that the pool of individuals who can receive restitution is victims of crimes considered at sentencing. And so to the extent that Section 13A, Factor 1, reiterates that, I believe it serves that function. But when reviewing the circuit court's decision here, it did not err in concluding that restitution was appropriate in order to make ND whole, in order to issue full restitution. And courts
yeah.
have...
Yeah, so that, yeah, and I think that's true if you consider the entirety of Mr. Whiskerton's... How do you pronounce the name? I'm sorry. Is it Whiskerton? I'm sorry?
Whiskerton.
Okay, thank you. If we consider all of Mr. Whiskerton's activities as alleged by the victim, that would be true. They're getting to full restitution. The question is whether that is the universe that we must consider. So tell me this. Is it possible, or are there other principles in criminal law that would prevent this? Is it possible to look at this relatively discrete period of time, a couple of weeks, as a continuing burglary, right? So convicted of burglary, but there was a couple of weeks of activity that led up to that. Can we consider that a continuing violation of the law such that we could rope that within the definition of crime considered at sentencing?
There are certainly markers in common tying Mr. Whiskerton's conduct into one continuous scheme. His conduct occurred the very moment that he expertly modified ND's basement storm window to obtain undetectable and easy access to her home.
Could we say that was the beginning of the burglary and the incident in which he was caught was the end of the burglary?
That's certainly an option available to this court, and that initial activity did inform his May 8th burglary, as I mentioned before. Those prior entries allowed him to know that ND had some money in her home that day. He had a hideout as a result of his activities there before. He knew where to hide. He was upstairs when ND came home and went upstairs. He was able to exit quickly on the day of May 8th. There's, as the Court of Appeals here found, there are certainly many factors that tie all of Mr. Wiskirchen's criminal conduct together. And I'd actually like to discuss Section 5 in the statute.
Could, before you do that, now that we have the context set up, could you get back to my question about were there any findings of fact, explicitly or implicitly made by the court, that undergirds his conclusions?
The court found that Mr. Wiskirchen's activities were responsible for the missing property. It found that he had repeatedly entered her home. It gave and credibility to MD's testimony that he had entered prior to May 8th, that there was no debris around the modified window as there would have been if he had just done it that day, that there was a nest in her bedroom closet. All of this testimony existed at the circuit court's hearings, and as Your Honors mentioned earlier, the PSI supported this conclusion that I believe the circuit court characterized his activities as a daily job, that over the course of these 2 weeks, Mr. Wiskirchen entered ND's home, took these items, and therefore all of the missing items were attributable to his
Would it be
conduct.
Correct to say, rather than any kind of testimony or hearing, that the circuit court relied on the statements that were in the PSI? I'm asking. I don't know the answer.
I think it's both, that the circuit court, when reciting the evidence that supported its conclusion, mentioned some statements that were made in the PSI. In addition, one example is Wiskirchen's mother told ND on May 8th that he was repeatedly in her home prior to that date. He possessed her medication as well, both the testimony and the PSI, some of which was redundant with the testimony, informed the circuit court's conclusion here. And Mr. Wiskirchen had an admitted pattern of burglarizing homes in order to obtain money for drugs. Two of his prior convictions were for theft. In one example, he entered a home also through a window, and thankfully the victim was present and scared him off. In another, he entered an apartment and drank alcohol and, I believe, made food, and those were the types of items that ND claimed missing here. And the items that ND reported missing were sorts of easily pawnable items. And Mr. Wiskirchen admitted that he had a contact in Illinois who would sell these stolen items for him in order to obtain money for drugs.
My concern is that this not be so broad, that it would interfere with any kind of due process rights, maybe. Or, for instance, what if a victim is claiming restitution for, I'm not saying this victim, but hypothetically, for a ring that she forgot that she gave to a niece? What about, apparently there's in the record that he told the PSI writer that he had burglarized between 100 to 200 homes. I hope he didn't do all that in the 2 weeks. He would have been awfully busy. 100 to 200 homes and had never been caught. What if someone comes forward and says, I think he burglarized my home, took $1,000 worth of merchandise, and I want restitution? How can we cabin this?
There are certainly many limits to restitution. Many of those limits are present in the text of the statute. So, as we argue in our brief, one are limits the individuals eligible to receive restitution, victims of crimes considered at sentencing. Section 13 limits the circuit court's discretion to appropriate restitution. And in that vein, courts have focused on the concept of related acts.
Causal nexus, is that the phrase you use, that you mean?
No, that's another limitation that Your Honor is discussing, and that has come from case law interpreting the restitution statute, that the defendant's criminal actions must have set into motion the events causing the victim's loss. So certainly there are many limitations to restitution. For example, if an individual had robbed the victim in this case on a bus 20 years ago, the connecting factors that the Court of Appeals found in this case and in the Cueva case are not present. It's separated in time chronologically. It's not the two-week span that we have here. The acts don't really seem to be related. And when we look at whether restitution is appropriate, we focus on the statutory purposes of restitution, to make the victim whole and to rehabilitate the defendant. And there's certainly an argument that ordering restitution for a crime 20 years ago doesn't serve the end of rehabilitating the defendant for any particular offense.
Along the lines of what I think Justice Bradley has been trying to get at, is there a limitation as well, though, in terms of the findings that the court needs to make at the particular restitution hearing? And isn't this record very different from what happened in Cueva, where there was a finding by a preponderance of the evidence that these crimes had been committed by the individual? And I'll note that in Cueva, they weren't even seeking the prior burglaries restitution. It was only the security camera that was directly connected to the crime itself. Whereas here, we've got a record. There is some record of the things that you've said, but there is not findings particular to certainly a level of preponderance of the evidence that these burglaries, that the court was finding that they, in fact, occurred and resulted in the loss of this property that she was claiming. Do you see that as a limitation that perhaps wasn't present here, even if we accept your argument generally?
I think that this case is very similar, almost indistinguishable from Cueva. And although the circuit court perhaps didn't articulate its factual findings as specifically as the circuit court in Cueva did, the evidence is very similar. In Cueva, I believe speculation supported the victim's belief that someone had been burglarizing.
Well, they had
home.
The video camera. They had seen the similar faces that they could compare the height and the build. I mean, there was a lot, I think. There was a lot more facts connecting them, and again, they weren't seeking the prior restitution from the prior burglaries.
Well, so the camera actually, the video wasn't specific enough to identify the particular defendant, but in the same way here, ND walked in on Mr. Wisperton in
on
the
May
midst
8th.
Of her.
Correct?
That's right, but there is substantial evidence supporting that conclusion that he had been in her home before and he was responsible for the missing items. I mentioned his admissions to the PSI writer that
which he then denied having made, correct? He
I'm
denied
sorry,
making those admissions to the PSI writer at his sentencing?
It was only a partial denial. He denied that he told the PSI author that he had burglarized 100 to 200 homes in the county. But he never denied that the reason he entered ND's home on May 8th is because he knew that she had some money in the home. He also admitted at sentencing that he had burglarized at least a couple homes before. He admitted that he had burglary skills that he had acquired from a friend. The physical evidence corroborated that he had been entering her home and taking these items. As I mentioned, there was no debris around the window that had been expertly modified. And his admitted pattern of burglarization, the circuit court concluding that this was a daily job of sorts, all supports that more likely than not, which is the circuit court's standard, these missing items were due to Wisperton's criminal conduct. And this court reviews that conclusion under an erroneous exercise of discretion standard. So this court need not arrive at that same conclusion de novo. The question is whether a reasonable jurist could have concluded that based on the evidence before the court that by preponderance of the evidence, Mr. Wisperton was responsible for all of ND's missing items.
Right, but that assumes that the criminal activity that resulted in the loss actually occurred, right?
That the criminal activity resulted in the missing property. Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. So isn't the reason I ask, I'm a little concerned about the due process before we deprive someone of their property. So isn't the purpose for the definition of crimes considered at sentencing, because that results from some agreement between the prosecution and the defense about what can be considered?
As an initial matter, with respect to due process concerns, as this court has already mentioned, courts routinely consider uncharged conduct, acquitted conduct, dismissed conduct for the purpose of actually increasing an offender's term of imprisonment. And depriving them of liberty is, I don't see why there would be different reasons, different constitutional concerns depriving them of property. And Mr. Wiskirchen does not raise any constitutional arguments here. He has waived.
Right.
Or for-
but if he were to say, look, I deny that I took any of this stuff on previous occasions, and I've not agreed that you can consider that as part of my sentencing. And the court nonetheless says, oh, but we will. The victim says this occurred, and so we're not going to have a trial on liability. We're not going to have any inquiry into that. There's no agreement that this occurred, and we're going to deprive you of property without any finding of liability first.
There has to be a conclusion by preponderance of the evidence in order to deprive the defendant of the property. And in this case, as a matter
right,
of
but
fact...
There's no actual trial about that, right? I mean, you know, the victim's not getting up and testifying, and the defendant's saying, okay, you know, let's have a little trial about whether that actually happened. There's none of that. There's just the victim saying this, and the court saying, well, if I can find, based on what the victim says, by preponderance of the evidence that it occurred, we're done. We order restitution.
The restitution statute allows the defendant to raise any defense that he would in order to contest restitution, in addition to defenses raised in a civil action. And although the restitution statute allows the court to conduct informal hearings, that just suggests that the legislature meant to give courts broad discretion in order to conduct these hearings and determine what justice required. And Mr. Wiskirchen's position is that he should have to pay zero restitution because his criminal conduct occurred over the course of 2 weeks, as opposed to just taking everything in the span of one morning or what have you. And that is actually a violation of ND's constitutional rights as a victim of crime, for her to recover absolutely nothing as a result of this conduct. And
so is it an all-or-nothing proposition, then? She either gets restitution based on the totality of what she believes was taken, or she gets nothing? There's no in-between?
That's Mr. Wiskirchen's position, is that she should receive nothing. And given the facts of this case, that's what he argues, that he should not have to pay any restitution because she cannot identify which items were taken on which particular day. And that is giving him a windfall based on the extended criminality that he engaged in. And certainly under Section 1R, that's unlawful because the court is required to order restitution to victims unless they find substantial reason not to do so. And the fact that he was hiding out in her closet for 2 weeks is not really a good or substantial reason not to do so.
But she didn't get all of the money to pay for all of the things she said were stolen.
That's
the
right.
The amount of money that she was given was, well, little more than about a third, but not even that, about a quarter maybe.
That's right, Your Honor. It was only a portion mm-hmm. of the value of items that she reported stolen, because her insurance company was responsible for some of that loss.
Doesn't the state have the option in this type of situation of charging the conduct, of getting the read-ins or pursuing the charges in terms of making sure?
I mean, I absolutely, we've got a victims' rights statute. We should make sure the victims are made whole. But we also have to look at the specific restitution statute, the law that's surrounding that statute, and it really does have limitations based on 13 sub A sub 1 that I don't think you can just look at sub 5 and conclude that 1 doesn't apply or that you can circumvent it. So isn't that the option that the state would have had here to really ensure that the victim was protected and her rights were protected?
Certainly the state is not suggesting that Section 13, Factor 1, does not apply.
If you can use 5 for anything, I mean, as Justice Kelly was saying, I think you negate 1. You negate the specific limitation that 1 has that is as a result of a crime considered at sentencing, which has a definition that's set forth in the statute. So, I mean, getting back to the question of, doesn't the state have the option of charging the conduct, of pursuing the charges, of reading them in, of negotiating the plea?
The prosecutor certainly has options to charge criminal conduct in different ways, but we reject the idea that conduct needs to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt in order for a court to consider it at sentencing. And as to Section 13, the language of Section 13, which says in deciding whether to order restitution or the amount of, it allows Factor 1 to be a part of that pie chart, but Section or Factor 5 allows the court, in its discretion, in unique situations like this one, to order restitution for other losses caused by the defendant's criminal conduct in order to make the victim whole under Section 1R. And I'd actually like to make the point about the civil lawsuit, because Mr. Wiskirchen raised that option earlier, that he could ND could bring a civil lawsuit to recover. The whole point of Section 5 in the restitution statute, as this court has previously said, is to save crime victims the time and the expense and the hassle of filing an additional lawsuit. And he's effectively conceded that she would be able to recover for her losses. And that's what Section 5 allows her to do. The proof would be similar. She would allege the same facts in a court for conversion or trespass to property or the like. So in order to, if this court were to require her to do that, that contravenes one of the very important purposes of the restitution statute.
Before your time expires, I wanted to ask you a question about the surplusage problem or potential problem there. Can't we interpret 13A sub 5 as a catch-all provision so that 13A sub 1 through 4 are important because the legislature wants to make sure that the courts consider, and the wording is shall consider each of those four things, but the legislature indicated that it does not want to confine a court to considering only 1 through 4, hence the catch-all provision in 5.
That's certainly correct, Your Honor, that the legislature wanted to mandate a court consider these enumerated factors. And as with many lists that the legislature or Congress creates, it has enumerated particular items and then added an additional item as this sort of catch-all category in order to allow circuit courts to do what the circuit court here did, which is order restitution in order to allow ND to recover and to make her whole. You know, the whole statute is peppered with discretionary language.
Counsel, can I just ask you about, I know your time is coming to an end, I'm curious about alternative relief. Let's assume that the court rules against you today. It seems pretty clear from the plea hearing that the court itself thought there was going to be a big number ordered in restitution. All of the figures at the sentencing involved big numbers for restitution. Granted, there was a restitution hearing requested, but it's not. I was reviewing that transcript, too. I didn't see where the defense or the defendant said, we intend to pay nothing or we're going to fight this on restitution. I mean, there was sort of this benefit of thinking there's going to be restitution paid. You ask for a new restitution hearing. Shouldn't you be asking that the plea be unwound, this be back before the trial court, either for a trial or for an entirely new sentencing? And because the court proceeded and the victim proceeded and the defense seemed to proceed and the state proceeded under the notion that a fairly large number of restitution was going to be paid in this case.
I see my time has expired.
You may answer the question.
I think your characterization is correct, Your Honor. At the plea hearing, the defendant said he acknowledged that he understood that he would be required to pay restitution to the victim of his crime. And that is significant, that he acknowledged that some monetary restitution was at issue. And the court even said, too, that it would be able to impose the maximum criminal fine, which was $25,000, as opposed to this $8,700 restitution amount. So certainly, with regard to due process arguments, the defendant had adequate notice that he would be required to pay restitution.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so to start, I'd like to address, I think, a question and a concern of both Justice Kelly and Justice Dallet. Justice Kelly's concern was about this, I guess the question of whether this is really alleging a continuing course of conduct and expanding the scope of the crime considered at sentencing to the defendant's conduct that's alleged. So I guess the first thing I would say to that is that, and I think this addresses at least partially Justice Dallet's concern about how this could have been handled differently or how it could be handled in the future, in this case even. So what is absolutely clear from the record is that the state did not charge this as a continuing course of conduct with a series of ongoing burglaries. Mr. Wiskirchen was not put on notice of that sort of allegation or anything like it until after his plea in this case. That's the first point in the record that anything about prior alleged burglaries or this huge list of allegedly stolen items comes
from. He was convicted of burglary. And according to the evidence that came out at sentencing, that burglary took place over an extended period of time. Why can we not, for purposes of restitution, say, well, here's the crime for which he was convicted, so it falls within the definition of a crime considered at sentencing, burglary, and here's the extent of it that was described by the victim. Why can't we look at that as a package and say restitution is based on that?
Yeah, so I think what the court would have to do, and I could understand the circuit court having that concern, is go to the text of the statute where specifically for restitution purposes, as opposed to all other sentencing purposes, we define what the crime considered at sentencing is. And if generally it's permitted for the court to consider a defendant's entire course of conduct, the term entire course of conduct appears nowhere in the statute. It's very limited to a crime of conviction and any write-in charges.
So why shouldn't this be unwound? Why shouldn't it go back for a new sentencing in light of what we know the restitution figure to be, so the victim can be fully heard, the state can make its arguments, the court can sentence this person based upon the rest. I mean, really, it sounds like courts should be doing restitution hearings first, so that everyone knows what the story is, and people can't, on one hand, act like they're going to pay restitution for everything, and the court proceed and the victim proceed in that regard, and on the other hand, later say, no, you kind of have to commute it down to this. I mean, maybe you're right, but if you are, shouldn't there be a new sentencing where everyone has the opportunity to be heard? Maybe the entire plea should be undone, and the state could decide if it wants to charge it differently.
So what I would
say
about,
shouldn't some of those things happen instead so we also comply with victim rights?
Yeah, so obviously that issue was never raised until now, if it is being raised at all. And second, the plea agreement in this case is explicit. It was put on the record at the plea hearing, and then it was to some extent supplemented by the plea questionnaire form where the read-in charges were put on the record.
If you read that, you see that the court and everybody was thinking this is going to be a big figure.
Well, I think restitution was clearly on the table, but the issue that we're deciding now, or that this court's deciding, is the scope of restitution. And That was not known at the time of this plea. So Mr. Wiskirchen enters this plea where he's charged with four crimes. The state makes allegations of intimidation of a witness, and that specifically was uncharged pursuant to the plea agreement. So the state and Mr. Wiskirchen come to an agreement to resolve these charges, and that's put on the record. That's what Mr. Wiskirchen agreed to. The fact that maybe the state could have done this differently isn't a reason for this court to rewrite the statute or expand the scope of criminal restitution beyond what has ever been expanded to prior to State v. Cleaver. Looking at the case law that comes before Cleaver and upon which Cleaver purportedly relies, none of the facts in those cases at all expands the scope of a defendant's conduct to authorize restitution for alleged prior crimes that are similar or involve the same victim or involve the same type of crime. Never before until Cleaver, which does have very unique facts, the restitution ordered in that case is substantially, and I think it is distinguishable from this case in the sense that there, based on all this evidence that it was Cleaver and the findings of the circuit court that Cleaver did commit these prior burglaries, and the causal nexus that I think that the court relied upon there, that's at least somewhat distinguishable from this case, is that the court didn't order restitution for prior alleged burglaries that weren't read in and that Cleaver was never convicted of. The court ordered restitution for this very specific loss of the victim, for the security system that she used, essentially to catch Cleaver. So that was a causal nexus there. That's substantially different than we have here. I see my time is up.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for good arguments. This is an interesting case for us to ponder over this afternoon. We are going to adjourn now, and the court will reconvene in closed conference at 3:10. We are adjourned.